I'm Kay Bess, and this is The Beehive. Women in voiceover, the voices of the fairer sex that keep the wheels of commerce and creativity moving in this country. Voices you hear every day, but names you likely don't know until now. Hey everybody, welcome to The Beehive. Before we get started, I want to give a big shout out to Townsend Coleman, who is a voice actor extraordinaire, who also happened to come in and revamp my podcast studio, with power tools and everything. And he helped me with some new equipment. So I just wanted to give a big shout out, Townsend. Thank you so much for helping with everything. And now we're going to get started with today's podcast. My guest is Tina Marasco, who brings such an interesting perspective to voiceover because she is a voice actor, but she's also been a talent agent at two very prestigious talent agencies in New York City. So you know Tina from the hit HGTV franchise, Love It or List It. I mean, wow, how many seasons has it been on?
It's been 6 years. We're on our 13th season.
13 seasons. She's voiced hundreds of TV and radio commercials. You also, if there was a picture of her, which you can go to the podcast website and find a picture of her, on camera, you might recognize her from such shows as Jane the Virgin, Castle, Parks and Recreation, Two and a Half Men, and many, many others. So I'm so happy to have you here, Tina.
I am so thrilled to be here. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
And I would like you to do that intro in my head every morning when I wake up. It would be a really good ego boost.
Well, I've recorded it, so I'll give you a copy and you can take it home.
I just might do that.
I always start with asking how someone began in voiceover. But I would like to know, first off, how you became an agent.
Well, it's one of those things, when I look back at my life story, I really have to recognize that I have just trusted in the universe or God to lead me on my path. So I was an undergrad student at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And like every red-blooded American young girl, I had a great time in school.
What did you study?
What did I study? Communications.
Was that your major?
Yes, yeah. With a minor in philosophy.
I majored in philosophy.
Yeah. Oh, did you really?
Yes.
Oh, we should talk to you later.
We should. That'll be fun for the listeners.
Yes, exactly. I just had a great time in college. I was a cheerleader. I went out all the time. I had a great social life. And I had graduated. No resume. And the day after graduation, I was on the phone with my girlfriend who had graduated a year prior. And she said, "So what are you going to do?" And I was like, "I don't know, thick Jersey accent, nasal, projection." And she said, "Well, you always wanted to act, right?" And I said, "Yeah." And she's like, "Well, why don't you get a job?" She at the time worked at William Morris. And she said, "Why don't you get a job here? And you can learn all about the business. You can take acting classes at night." She had it all worked out for me.
Wow.
And when you're ready to make the switch, you'll have all that information. And I kid you not, 3 days later, I was picking up Julia Roberts dry cleaning and I was an agent trainee. And I mean, it's by the grace of God. I knew nothing about being an agent. I didn't even know what an agent did. But I think what ended up getting me the job was I was just authentic because I didn't know anything else, right? I didn't have any pretense to put on. So I was just myself and I was eager to learn and And I think that goes a long way.
Being eager to learn goes a very long way.
And, being conscientious and all of that. And so I started as in the mailroom as an agent trainee. And I was, if you ever saw the movie Swimming with Sharks, it was that, I would see crazy agents like throwing stuff across their offices. This was like early 90s. Yeah. So we're still leftover from the 80s.
Yes.
Decadence.
Crazy.
And
80s.
And I floated around from one department to another and I landed in TV lit for a while, which was fascinating, but a little slower paced than what I was really comfortable with. And eventually ended up in the commercial department working for Carol Baker, who was like the maven of New York voiceover. I don't know if you've ever heard of her.
No,
but,
I haven't.
Oh my goodness. She had
That's a whole
a knowledge,
different world yeah, in New York.
Yeah. But her knowledge base was epic. And she was such a born mentor. I mean, she really just wanted to teach me everything she knew. And I was hungry to learn. And so it was just this perfect relationship. And, you know, I was just this kid wet behind my ears. And I would have celebrities coming in. And they would be like, Tina, go put Alec Baldwin on tape. And I'd be like, okay. And then it'd be like, that was really good, Alec. Let's try one without the rasp. God bless him. He was so kind and never like, you know, he probably was like patting me on the head proverbially. And but he was just kind and lovely. And I learned so much just on the job. And at that time, the assistants did a lot of the submitting and finding talent. I mean, we found like Jon Stewart. He was just a young guy going out on Clearasil commercials and Calista Flockhart and Gillian Anderson. And It was just a very, very cool, interesting time. And we had some powerhouse talent that I just got to observe and learn from.
You know, I have to say, we journeyman voice actors, we complain sometimes about celebrities doing voiceover work. And I always felt like if you're good at it, it doesn't matter if you're a celebrity. And I have to say, I think Alec Baldwin
He's
is
fantastic.
Just one of my favorite voice actors. He's just really good at it. It's when you get into, you know, voice acting that's not so great
right.
and they're only doing it because they are a celebrity,
right.
then it gets a little bothersome to me. But I never would begrudge anyone who was actually good at it.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
And you know, we ran across several who, when I then went to ICM, and that's, you know, the next part of the journey, we were building a department at the time. And so we would bring celebrities in who were represented theatrically by ICM and all of the agents, because this was now like the early to mid 90s. Voiceover was just the hottest ticket
thing
in town, right? So every celebrity wanted to get a piece of it. And so they would all send them to us and we would put them in the booth. And I would say, you know, the majority were like, you know what? God bless. I thought this was going to be way easier. And they would tip their cap and go, you know, thanks for giving me a shot. But it wasn't for them. And some of them had the humility to recognize that and move on. And others, you know, kind of thought that their name would carry them.
Yeah, sure.
And they too were humbled. But when they're good, you know, one of the best voiceover, you know, when we found him, he wasn't a celebrity yet. We found Liev Schreiber right out of his Yale showcase. And right from the get-go, I was like, wow, this guy is, I mean, he's going to be huge. And in the voiceover booth, he just created magic. I mean, just his intention is so clear. You
so
hear
strong,
everything
yeah.
that, every thought that's in his head comes through his voice. And sure enough, he went on to have an incredible career. And he's still doing voiceover to this day. So
interesting. Do you recall having any sense when you were agenting about the differences between what kind of things are available to women versus men?
Yes, it was very, very clear. And especially when I just started, it was, I would say, almost 75-25 weighted men to women.
Yeah.
And, you know, it we've made progress. We've made a lot of progress. But it's a slow, steady progression.
Yeah.
It's going at glacier speed. You know, it's...
Yeah. I still feel like it's, if you really look at every genre of voiceover, even video games, where there is a lot of work for women, there's just exponentially more work for men.
Absolutely.
You know, so it is. It's an interesting thing. And it's a little hard to track, I think. But and our own experiences are so myopic. You know?
Right.
But,
I mean, even as an agent, when you have the whole perspective, it was very clear. It was clearly weighted heavily male. But that's what makes the women who succeed in this business even more special.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
You know, I think I do. I think I mentioned it somewhere that it's like you got to be really good to be the cream to rise to the top
Absolutely.
Of the glass.
Because you're not only rising to the top of your gender, you're rising to the top of, you know, like a business that's heavily weighted against your gender.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, exactly. So then how did you get to ICM?
So this is a great story. So 3 years passed at William Morris and I was having a great time. And they came to me and said, all right, it's time. Get your client list together. We're going to promote you. And I went home that night and I was like, wait.
Promote you as?
Oh, I was an assistant at William Morris for those 3 years.
Okay.
So I didn't become a full talent agent until ICM.
Got it. Okay.
So we're going to make you an agent. And I thought, wait, what am I doing? I always wanted to act. What happened to that part of the plan, you know?
Yeah.
And I had a dark night of the soul of really, really doing some deep searching. And I thought, gosh, I'm 24 at this point.
Wow.
Do I take the corner office and the expense account and the nice salary? I mean, William Morris in New York back in the day was pretty cushy.
Absolutely.
And, you know, if you do that, if you take door number one, you're never going to enter door number two or door number three. That's going to be your path, most likely.
Right.
And I thought, God, before you take that shiny that shiny offer, you better really think about it. And so, you know, with deepest gratitude, I went back to them and I said, God, I'm so, you know, honored. And while I deeply appreciate this offer, I think I have to pursue what I've always dreamed of doing. And I shared it with them and they said, okay, you're our family. We'll represent you. And I was like, what? And they did. I mean, this was the commercial and the soap opera department. I wasn't represented by, you know, the theatrical department.
But still.
Oh, it was amazing.
Yeah.
So I got my waitress job. I got into an acting class in New York. And
love that. It's like,
yeah,
I got the waitress job.
Yeah, exactly. Like, check. Yeah. Step one.
To being an actor.
Exactly. Yeah. And boy, I was bad at both. I was the worst waitress you could ever imagine. I was great with the people, but you try to get me to open a bottle of wine, I would be like trying to distract them with my funny stories while I'm like craning it open with my, you know, in between my legs.
I used to take the bottle away.
Right.
You're never
you're not supposed to do. Right, exactly.
But I'm like, I'll be right back. I don't think I figured out how to use a proper corkscrew until maybe 3 years ago.
I thought I was
and
the
now
only
I'm
one.
Great at it.
Oh, yeah, see?
I just drink more wine. Right.
Well, there's that.
Is the mother of invention.
If only I had known.
Yeah.
That was the key. And so about 6 months of that went by, and I was going to these auditions, and I was truly seeing these incredible actors who were all doing their emotional preparation and marking their scripts. And I was like, well, my hair looks good. That's all I have going for me. And I felt like a fraud. And I hated that feeling because, you know, I had always always had pride in, you know, being.
I prided myself.
Is that right? Yeah. Is prided the proper?
It is.
Okay. On being excellent at what I did or really, you know, working hard to get to that level of excellence. And I just wasn't there. And at the time, Stephen Arcieri, who was a major, major force in New York agenting, had left CESD in New York, gone to ICM to start to head their celebrity voiceover department. Mm-hmm. And the New York office of ICM was killing it in scale voiceover at the time. I mean, they just were making so much money. And so the New York office was like, well, we want a piece of that. And Stephen was like, well, I just came here to do celebrities. I have no interest in doing a scale department. They said, well, find somebody. And so he was searching and searching and searching. And you know, all the casting directors would say, well, our favorite assistant was at William Morris, but she's acting now, air quotes, and we don't know how happy she is, so you might want to talk to her. So I went in, I met with him, and, you know, I resisted as long as I could because I really didn't know if I had given enough time. And one night I came home from my waitress job. It was 3 a.m. I'll never forget. I was eating SpaghettiOs out of the can. I was watching Dick Van Dyke on Nick at Night. And I had margarita slap all over my like arms. I'm sticky. I'm disgusting. I'm demoralized because I was a terrible waitress. And, you know, my answering machine was blinking. And I play the message. And it's Steven. And he says, okay. You're my first choice, but I have to, you know, I have to make a decision tomorrow. If you want the job, call me at 9 a.m. It's yours. And I looked down at my SpaghettiOs and I looked up at Dick Van Dyke and I was like, all right, I'm back. And I went there and that was the most extraordinary experience in my agenting life because we had one client. And boy, what a client to start with. We had Peter Thomas Sr. I don't know if you're familiar with him. Oh, he was like the quintessential voiceover. He narrated every documentary you've ever listened to on, you know, PBS. Yes, he's like the grandfather of all voiceover and the kindest, gentlest, sweetest man. I mean, and he just recently passed away, like within the year. So, and so Stephen and I sat down and we really looked at the New York landscape and said, New York doesn't need another voiceover department. So if we start just stealing clients from every other agency, we're just going to get lost in the shuffle. So what we decided was we were going to reinvent the wheel and we were going to find performers from all different walks of life. So we went to Broadway and off-Broadway and stand-up and performance art. And if I saw like a cool, you know, guy doing poetry on the street, I would grab him and bring him in. Like we... There was just no boundaries, no limits on who we would try out. And so we were just bringing in all of these really eclectic people and throwing them in the booth and giving them copy and just seeing what they created.
Yeah.
And because of that, we developed this very unique department. And that's how I really learned. That's how I got my chops in terms of directing and producing, because none of these people had voiceover careers. Right. So we taught them how to do voiceover. We taught them how to take what they had that made them special and then kind of fit it into the parameters of voiceover while keeping their, you know, uniqueness. And then we produced demos for each and every one of our clients. So we created our very first agency CD with, you know, however many, 50 clients. I produced every single one of those demos from scratch. So what a learning experience it
was. What a learning experience,
and then just putting that agency on the map, you know, going out with buyers and, you know, promoting these clients who nobody had ever heard of. And we just started becoming the buzz of of New York. And it was so gratifying.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
And I think it brings home the point that it's that intangible thing that someone possesses that makes for an interesting voice actor. It isn't necessarily the sound of your voice. It's something in you. It's some other.
Absolutely.
And you can teach someone where to stand by a microphone. And, you know, all those little details, right?
Absolutely.
And that's amazing. What an amazing experience.
It was.
To truly witness it in so many people who walk through the door that you grabbed and brought through the door.
And I think that's the best part. That's what I still love to this day is going like, gosh, you know, my good friend Sally Winters. Do you know Sally? She's you know, she's sort of now she's become a lawyer, but she had a remarkable run in voiceover for these last like 20 some odd years. And she was my bartender at like the Raccoon Lodge. And I loved her voice. And I brought her in and I gave her a couple of lessons. I sent her off to get some instruction, came back. She booked the first audition that she had for real once I signed her, and then just took off and had this monster career. And to this day, when we talk, like she gets teary, you know, going like, gosh, if, you know, if I hadn't met you, I would never have had this experience. And that was what was so fulfilling as an agent.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing. Tell me about your transition from being an agent to being talent.
So that's another one of those stories that, you know, you're just sort of magically guided. It's a much, much longer story, but for my birthday, a dear friend of mine got me a psychic reading, right? And I was like, oh, I don't know how I feel about this, but I didn't want to like deny the gift.
Sure.
And so in New York, every psychic is also a Broadway performer. So this guy was in like Damn Yankees on Broadway. So he could only come see me at midnight on a Friday after a show, right? And so he comes and I'm very dubious and he comes in and he's, you know, doing my cards and he's like, oh. And at the time I was engaged to be married. I had an apartment on 78th and 5th Avenue in New York. I was in like the maid's quarters, but it was a prime location right across from Central Park and the Met. And I had this incredible job. Like I loved my job. I loved my clients so much. I loved going out and watching their performances. But every time I went, I did have this pang of like, gosh, I would love to be up there. Like, what would that feel like? You know?
Yeah.
And, but I never said it out loud or admitted it. And so he's reading my cards and he's like, you are not doing what your soul was put on this earth to do. And I said, what do you mean? And he's like, well, you're an actor. I said, no, you know, because I know more than the psychic. I was like, no, I work with actors. I'm surrounded by actors. That's probably what you're seeing. And he said, no, you are an artist. And I was like, no, 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 I tried that. I was really bad. I promise you, I was terrible. And he said, listen, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Get into an acting class and just do it for yourself. You know, just do it for the expression and then just see where it leads you.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I did. I got into this acting class and with this wonderful woman named Zena Jasper in New York. And I just fell in love. I mean, and I knew that if I was going to attempt this for a second time, I had to do it the right way. And I thought all of my clients who I really deeply respected, the one thing they had in common was very, very, very high quality training. And so I thought, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to isolate myself in an MFA program somewhere, get 3 years of acting and performance and voice and speech and movement and all of that.
Yeah.
And really train, not, you know, kind of do it haphazardly. And also I needed to extricate myself from my agent persona in New York, which I had spent basically 6 years cultivating, and go away somewhere and then come back and reinvent myself. So I decided that I would, if this was really what fate wanted me to do, I would suicide one school, only apply to one school and audition for one school. And I decided it should be Rutgers because at the time, Bill Esper, who's like a master acting teacher, was heading that program. And I was still a New Jersey resident, so I could save a little money. Mm-hmm. And I auditioned. I had to learn a Shakespeare monologue and a contemporary. And I was a mess. I mean, like, but I was a real, again,
you're a genuine
really
mess.
Hard worker and a yeah. genuine mess, right? And I wanted it so badly. And I set my intention on it so precisely. And I think that paid off. And so, you know, 1,000 people audition and they take 18.
Wow.
And I got in.
Wow.
And it was crazy. So, you know, that's, and much to Stephen Arcieri's chagrin, I, you know, kind of left my agent world and went into the acting world. But again, he was so supportive and we found, you know, somebody amazing to take over. And they took the reins from there.
Wow. So you finished that program at, mm-hmm. at Rutgers, mm-hmm. and then how'd you get yourself to Los Angeles?
So at the time, my husband moved out to San Francisco during the hedge fund craze. And when that sort of died down, he was like, all right, where are we going, New York or LA? And I thought, gosh, New York was the obvious choice, but maybe if I really want to reinvent myself, I should go to LA. Mm. So we decided to do that. And I finished the 3-year program and convinced them that we needed to do a showcase in LA as well as New York. And so it was the first year we ever did that, and came out and got agents right away. And this is where my first real mentor in the LA arena came in, which was Jeff Danis.
Okay.
So I produced my own voiceover demo before I graduated because I knew how to do that.
Sure.
And when I was an agent, there was never a thought in my head that I could be talent because, like I said, I had a very thick Jersey accent and it was very nasal. But then I went to 3 years of graduate school where I had voice and speech nonstop. And so you put those two components together.
Sure.
And it creates a voiceover career. You know, I had all the knowledge of what they wanted and what the pace and the cadence would be and, you know, what the direction meant and all of that. And now I had control over my instrument. And so I put those together. I made a demo that I produced myself. And I sent it to Jeff Danis, who I knew from, you know, being on the other coast.
Right.
He mostly dealt with Stephen, but, you know, we had a lot of interaction.
Sure.
And if anything, I thought he would discount me because of that experience. And he was like, I was about to discount you because of that experience. And then I listened to your demo and I thought, this is actually pretty good. So let's give it a shot. And back in those days, it was 1999 when I moved here.
Okay.
And that's when the lobby was in full bloom, when we would go in every day and without exaggeration have 15 to 20 pieces of copy because it was .com everything. It was
.com everything.
Everything. It was like, you know.
Those were the days.
Joe's Amazing Dentist.com. Do you know what I mean? It was like everything under the sun was advertising.
So many people had radio careers. I mean, we did all these radio spots and then there are tags on the radio spots and with phone numbers on the radio. I mean, it was amazing.
I know. I had a great run of phone numbers for a while.
Yeah.
And and so I booked things right out of the gate because of the sheer volume of how much we were auditioning. Sure. Yeah. And the rest is history. I became a client at ICM in LA, and then that turned into DPN.
Right.
And And then recently switched to Atlas a few years ago, but that's sort of how the career was started.
Yeah. That's an amazing path.
Yeah.
Truly. So you did, let's see, we just said this, 13 seasons, is that right?
Yes.
Of Love It or List It.
Let's keep it in the present tense. Still going.
You're doing.
Still going.
Yes. You're on your 13th.
Yes.
Perhaps 14th.
Yeah, coming up on 14.
Coming up on 14, yes. Let's keep it in the present
yes.
for sure. And it happens to be with a production company for which I did 4 seasons of The Property Brothers. So I know who you are working with and what a wonderful team of people that is. And I'm curious if you would qualify that as the best voiceover job you've had.
Without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, without a doubt. And you know this, and I love that we have shared this experience because this particular production company is of the highest quality.
Yeah.
Every single person that they hire is just as good as the one you worked with the week before. Yeah. And
this is Red Arrow
in
Knoxville, Tennessee.
Shout out to Danny and company.
Downing. Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Danny and Ryan
people.
And company. Yeah, they are the best. And honestly, I think the reason... Part of the reason it's so successful, not the show itself, because as you know, we kind of get plunked in afterward, but there's so much love there. I mean, they love what they're doing. We love what we're doing. The interaction is so positive and so uplifting that I think it just oozes out in the voice.
And I think too, I certainly got this sense working for them that they trusted me.
Yes.
And you know, nothing was ever belabored. It was like... It was clear that they hired you for a reason and they let you do what you do.
Yeah.
And that's just such a gift.
Yeah. But it's a very funny story how I got that job, which you'll probably be like, damn. So I had just recently
they were going to hire Kay.
No, but... I was practically giving it to you.
Oh, you were?
So I had just switched over to Atlas and I had spoken to our agent, Heather, and said, you know, I'd really like to do more narration. Up until that point, I had done a lot of like True Hollywood stories. Because those were in vogue in the early.
Well, and those were really the purview of ICM too.
Yes.
ICM clients had those. It was very, like if you ever got one and you weren't at ICM, it was like,
we
broke through. Yeah.
And those were fun.
Yeah,
those were
great
juicy fun to do. And I had booked several of those and I had gotten very close on, you know, a bunch of other narration things. And so, you know, she kind of filed that in her brain.
Yeah.
And when this job came up, it was a really, really last minute thing. And, I guess Danny had called Heather and said, listen, we're producing this pilot for HGTV. We don't know if it's going to get picked up. We don't know if it's going to go anywhere. But instead of having one of our producers do the scratch, I'd like to have, and this is what makes them so outstanding. We'll pay the money. It'll come out of our pocket, but we want to have a professional voiceover on it to put it in its best light.
Yeah. Great.
And she said, okay. And so she remembered what I said. And based on what the show was, she thought I was the right match. So she calls me and explains the situation. And at the time, I had like a frog in my throat. I was feeling a little under the weather. And to be perfectly honest, I was very insecure about my home studio.
Ah.
Very insecure about it. And she said, you know, he needs this in the next hour. Or, you know, can you do it? Blah, blah, blah. And I was like, you know, I'm feeling a little scratchy and I don't want to make a bad impression for you and I don't want to ruin the relationship and I just don't know if my home studio's up for it. And I hear radio silence, like dead silence for an uncomfortable period of time, like a good like 30 seconds. And she's like, in the way Heather can only do.
Yeah.
I don't think you're understanding the gravity of the situation, Tina. She's like, if this gets picked up, and she literally starts running the numbers on her calculator. She's like, this is what you could potentially be looking at. And I was like, I'll make a cup of tea and I'll book a studio right now. And so off I went. My friend owns a studio in Manhattan Beach. Shout out to Waterfront Sound and Steve. And he was able to take me and I loaded up on tea and honey.
That is great.
Did the first episode and truly... The rest is
that
history.
It
just hasn't stopped since. Knock on wood.
Yeah.
So.
That was my head. She was
that was
hitting.
Your head.
I'm okay.
But if only if she had listened to me, that it might have gone a very different way. So
wow,
very amazing. Grateful to her for pushing.
Tell me then the opposite, the 180 of that. Have you ever had just like a horrific experience in the studio where you think, oh, I should really give this up?
Yeah, on a regular basis. I was in New York, I think, 2 summers ago, and I booked a job, and it was a series of spots. I won't indicate what they were for. It was so in my wheelhouse. It was like what I do in my sleep for commercials. Yeah. And this producer was just, what I honestly think he was doing is he was hearing what I was doing, and then he would take that, and then he would give me that as the direction, as if I hadn't been doing that the whole time.
Right. Yes.
And it was driving me crazy because he kept making it like he was not satisfied, and like everything that he was hearing, he was telling me to do, and then I was doing it, and he was like, but you're not really doing it. I was like, I've been doing it the whole time.
Yeah, oh. It's so hard that you can't say it.
No.
I mean, you want to be able to say, can you just stop rolling and just back up?
Right.
And listen
to take
because
one.
Because that's what, yeah.
Right. And so I left that session and I walked to the Atlas offices in New York and I sat with Tim and I was like, I think it's over, Tim. I think it's over. Mm-hmm. I think my, you know, I think I, you know, everybody has their last job at some point. I think that might have been it. And he was like, no, stop it. You know, that producer is notorious for doing that. He overworks everyone. He even calls me when he books people and he says, just prepare your client that I like to really overdirect. And I'm thinking, if you know that about yourself, why do you continue? But and then I also had one early in my career where I was sick as a dog. And it's one of those things when you're new in voiceover, you want to please and you want to show up and you want to do your best. But at the time, I couldn't even, I still could project and make sound. But you know when you're so sick and it's in your chest and you can't really get a breath in, like you can't get a supported breath. Yeah. That's what was happening. And it was, I mean, it was just one of those things where they were so frustrated. And yet I was doing everything I could and I was burning up with fever. And, you know, and it was just one of those things where you leave and you're like, I don't know what would have been the better choice. Should I have just called in sick? And, you know, probably. And to this day, I don't know if they used me or if they replaced it. Yeah. You know, I squeaked out a couple of passable takes, but you always leave feeling like, you know, gosh, I just, you know, I just really didn't bring it. And sometimes it's out of your control. Then you have to make peace with it.
I remember doing a session once for Amica Insurance and I was so loaded up on cold medicine, you know, and I had never worked for them before. And I remember thinking, well, they don't really know what exactly my voice sounds like. Mm-hmm. I mean, I auditioned with this cold.
Oh, right.
You know, so... So it was hilarious. And I still have those, you know, I still have the.
Oh, so it worked out.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have the campaign. I'm sorry. This was 15 years ago. No, I have a copy.
Right.
And every time I listen to it, it's so clear that I have a chest cold, you know, but only I know that.
Right.
You know,
and that sound was in vogue for a long time.
A little scratchy.
Right, right. We want the Demi Moore, like, oh, okay, you want me on like day 3 of my flu? Perfect.
Yeah, exactly. That's great. And hungover?
Right.
Yes. I'm good. Totally dehydrated. I'm in.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Opening all those wine bottles.
Getting good. I want to know if you and you may have already said this, because they seem to be woven throughout your story, but a person who gave you a leg up in your career.
Mm.
I sort of view your career as all of a piece.
Yeah, it is.
You know, it really does feel that way. So I would just be curious if there's someone else that you might point out as like...
Oh, yeah. There were so many. So I've mentioned several of them. Jeff Danis in New York, in L.A. when I first moved here. And then when I switched to Atlas, I would say John Wasser, Lisa Marber-Rich, and Heather Virgo.
Yeah.
Atlas has breathed new life into my career and just reinvigorated me and set me on paths that I don't know if I would be on if it wasn't for them.
Yeah.
And I just adore them. I love their enthusiasm. I love their can-do attitude.
Mm-hmm.
I love just they're the worker bees of voiceover.
Yeah.
And I appreciate them so much.
I'm kind of amazed at the imprint that Atlas Talent Los Angeles has made in such a very short period of time, being here, sort of standing up next to agencies that have been here for decades and decades and decades. And it's quite a testament to the owners of the agency and also to that Los Angeles office as
well. Oh, absolutely.
I mean, really has had great people.
Yeah, they are tireless. They just work round the clock, and they work in such a positive way. Like, you never feel like they're being dragged down by this or they're exhausted. You come to them with an idea, the answer is always yes and. You know what I mean? It's like they're the improv masters of agenting. Yeah, they're amazing like that.
Yeah.
And truly, I'm inspired by them.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That's great. What's the most important lesson you would say that a career in voiceover, I want to say as an artist, has taught you?
I think being self-motivated. You know, when you have a 9-to-5 job and there are parameters with which you're supposed to meet, you can then meet those and exceed them. And everything's very like compartmentalized and fits in a box and makes sense. As an artist,
it's so measurable, right?
Yeah, it's so measurable. Yeah, it's so tangible. It's linear.
Yeah.
You know, as an artist, you're creating your career. You're creating your business, and your business is you. And, you know, just getting up every morning and being self-motivated to go, okay, what am I going to create today? Because you can't sit and wait to be hired. I mean,
no.
That's the icing on the cake, right?
That's the career killer.
Right. So you need to be creative in how you're going to develop and enrich your career on a daily basis. And so it's taught me great discipline, because I'm really good. If you throw the ball to me, I'll hit it every time.
Yeah.
And it's taken a lot of training and discipline to wake up every day and go, okay, what is on the docket today? And if there's nothing on the docket, creating something to put on the docket.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whether it's emailing a producer or coming up with an idea to bounce off my agents, or, you know, asking somebody to go out to lunch who I haven't seen, who's, you know, a contact from the business. I just think relationships are the most important component of being a successful artist in any way, because people want to work with who they like. And
yeah, that's so true.
You know, so forging those relationships, genuine, like we were talking about before, genuine, heartfelt connections to people, and not talking about work, not being, you know, manipulative and saying like, oh, if I take this person to lunch, they'll hire me. It's like, no, I haven't seen this person in a long time and they just had a baby and I want to hear how motherhood is and connect. And then they're just reminded, like, you know, how much they enjoy your company and your presence. And when something comes to mind that they can hire you for, then great. And that's how I've kind of made my whole career. And I think the longevity of my career has been based on repeat business.
Yeah.
I'm not a big booker of one-offs. You know, I will. Obviously, we all did. But I would say the majority of my career and my income is made off of repeat business.
Yeah.
It's relationship building and then, you know, being self-motivated.
I've had producers come back years later and you go, wow, I can't believe we worked on it. And, you know, and they'll say things like, I've been waiting for a project, you know, that you'd be right for. I'm like, wow.
Right.
I wouldn't have thought you would even remember my name, you know.
And it's humbling. But it just makes you realize, like, the power we have in connecting with people.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think, too, I find this, do you work at all in games, in video games?
Not so much.
I don't know if you've had this experience, but of late, I think because casting people, I think it's true. It doesn't matter if it's gaming or not. My latest experience of that has been that I was working on a game and the casting person was also the director of the game. Mm-hmm. And he made mention of the fact that he had heard me several times, you know, on auditions.
Right.
And essentially said, and I was just waiting for the right role, you know, and you realize, wow, that, you know, the auditions aren't going into the vast
ether.
Void
right.
of darkness, never to be,
right.
you know, listened to, but they're out there
right.
and people are listening to them and they go, yeah, I like that, but it's not right for this role, but I got to remember that.
Stick a pin in it, right.
What's her name?
Right.
And how, I mean, that was very gratifying.
Absolutely.
It makes you realize that your effort isn't for naught.
Absolutely. And sometimes, you know, we can feel that way because as you know how much this business has changed and it's opened up to anybody who has a microphone and a closet anywhere in the world
can be
auditioning for things, right? So many times we feel like it's just going to the ether And it's nice and to
get
that.
Sometimes it is.
And sometimes it is. But it's nice to get that reinforcement that, yeah, like, no, you know, good work is noticed.
Yeah.
And it matters.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to hear different casting people, how they organize their auditions. You know, like, I put it in, you know, this one spoke about how he would put them into three different categories. And one is no.
No.
That's like the biggest file.
Right, right.
No.
No.
And then there's the yes, right? And mm-hmm. then from the yeses come yes for this project,
uh-huh.
yes for another time.
Ah.
And I just thought that was fascinating. So, or perhaps yes, this is my first call. And if these people aren't available, mm-hmm. then I head over to my B list,
right,
where I have organized by, you know.
That's really neat.
To then pull over to the, you know, to the A,
right,
I guess.
To the now.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought that was so interesting. And everybody has a different way of doing
sure.
it. But again, it's that whole notion of business comes back around. If
absolutely.
You're doing good work.
Absolutely. It's
it
planting
comes back
seeds.
Around. Yeah.
Every audition is a seed planted.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether you realize that or not.
Yeah. You're auditioning for the next job.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you name any particular obstacle that you've had to overcome? Any, it's funny. I think of obstacles, you know, like, it could be any particular
sure.
period of your life where something didn't go the yeah. way you thought it might mm-hmm. and it shook you up.
Right.
And made you reevaluate.
Absolutely. I've had a lot of, I am a single mom
yeah.
and, I have a beautiful, hilarious 13-year-old daughter, and we have had a lot of ups and downs in
yeah.
her life, in her young life. And while we were going through a particularly difficult time health-wise for her, and she was hospitalized, and mm-hmm. my career was going in full tilt at the time.
Wow.
And it was really an interesting period to see how you, as an actress, are able to, you know, because we need these careers, right? I need these careers now. My daughter's in the hospital,
yeah.
and I need to be able to pay those bills.
And you need to qualify for your insurance.
Insurance, right. And,
yeah.
and yet, can I really show up the way I need to show up for work, knowing that this is going on, you know, in the rest of my life? I was pleasantly surprised to see that, yes, I could. And I love her. She is my heart,
yeah.
you know, walking around in physical form. And just knowing that I was able to compartmentalize and be professional enough to still show up job after job. At the time, I was very busy and nobody ever knew. Nobody, you know, even though I had relationships with these people, none of them, it wasn't like I was as close to them as, you know, I would be to a producer that I would tell. And I would show up and do my job and then return and go straight back to the hospital and be a, you know, be a loving,
be present,
doting,
yeah.
present mom. That was a real test. You know, I could have lost a lot of accounts and potentially even Love It or List It because it was an ongoing process with her. And I was able to really do both. And I think that just gave me a lot more self-confidence.
Yeah.
Like if I can get through that and still work and still turn out good work,
yeah.
I can do almost anything.
Yeah.
yeah.
It's interesting talking about the relationship that you have with your producers and the, mm-hmm. and the people that you, you know, when you have accounts and you're
yeah.
working with them every day and you do feel a sense of closeness to them. And at the same time,
mm-hmm.
we walk that line of, I cannot share too much because I cannot sow a seed of doubt in them.
Absolutely.
That I may falter.
Absolutely.
And you know, it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting line.
And it's also a lesson in time and place, right?
So sure, yeah.
In the booth when they're paying for a studio and you know, we have an hour to get out an hour show,
mm-hmm.
not the time or place.
Right.
When they come to California and I take them to dinner and we sit and we talk about our personal lives and I share and they're like, God, I had no idea that was
right.
going on.
Time and place,
right? So,
absolutely.
So the connection is there and the depth and the trust and all of that, but when it's appropriate, you know.
That is a huge point.
Yeah.
Because I think then too, what you're reflecting back to them is, a strength of character that you could endure something on a personal level that was frightening to you, that was really of utmost importance to you, and you could still be there for them.
Absolutely.
And that becomes just impressive.
Well, and it became impressive to me. Like, I grew so much as a human being and just, you know, was really proud of, obviously so proud of how my daughter got through that time, but so proud of how I got through that time and maintained my professionalism through it. And like I said, if, you know, when you are tested to that level and you come through it, from there on out, I'm like, bring it, you know, what could be more difficult than that?
Yeah. And how's your daughter?
She's thriving. Oh my goodness. She does video games. As a matter of fact, she is quite the little voiceover queen.
That's fantastic. Yeah. And she's also quite the ice skater.
Yeah. She's a competitive figure skater.
Yeah.
And an actress. So she's, but she came out doing jazz hands. I mean, like, this kid, like,
ow.
Yeah, I know. Yes, ow is right. This is one of those things that I would say I've never been sure of anything in my life, anything. Like I said, I just kind of follow the path and I'm like, okay, I'll just say yes, you know, and we'll see what happens. When I watch this child perform, whether it's on stage or on the ice or in the voiceover booth, every fiber of my being goes, oh my goodness, this is what she was put on this earth to do. And my roundabout crazy career makes me uniquely qualified to help her realize her dreams. And so it gives me the chills. It's the thing that I am. This is where my joy comes from now, sort of moving into the role of momager. And not in a, you know, crazy Kardashian way, but in a really supportive, like just wanting to see my
her
child.
Yeah, come true.
Like, just realize everything. So, that's sort of, you know, the other main component of my life right now.
Fantastic. Do you have a dream job, a dream voiceover job?
I think I'm living my dream voiceover job. Yeah, I'm telling you, it's that gratifying. There's so much joy in doing Love It or List It. My dream job going forward in the future is like, I would love for her to, you know, make it and have a platform and for us to find a project together to produce that maybe we could act in together that really helps people, that really helps kids, you know, teens that are going through, you know, struggles of their own and things that she went through in her early days that were obstacles and, you know, and just really being able to give back in that way.
Yeah.
That's my dream. And so we're working toward it.
Excellent. Well, we're going to play Beehive Roulette.
Ooh, that sounds fun.
So
it's my favorite game in Vegas.
Yeah? Wow. Let's get out the dice. Mm. So I have a list of 50 questions. We're not gonna do all of them, but you're going to answer 10.
Okay.
But you're going to call the numbers.
Oh, cool.
And then I'll tell you the corresponding question.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I'm going to start with, we have 50?
There are 50, you get 10.
Okay, I'm going to start with number 37.
Do you have a favorite piece of jewelry?
Ah, yes.
Jewelry.
Yes, jewelry.
I said that so strangely.
I know. Very trained. My mom's anniversary band. So both my parents have passed. So because I can, when I put it on my hand, I still see it on her finger.
Oh.
And whenever I have something, and sometimes it's voiceover still, that makes me nervous or I just feel like I need that additional support, I make sure I put it on in the morning and I'll like, you know, be in the booth and I'll just be sort of rubbing it to keep her close.
Oh, so, that's very sweet. Next.
Oh, I forgot. Number two.
Number two. What's your sign?
Oh, you know this. We're Pisces sisters. March 13th. Yeah. And I think I'm, you know, I have heard tale that I have a Virgo moon, which is it's very critical and perfectionistic. And so I think it kind of balances out my watery, easygoing, swimmy Pisces
fishy,
side.
Swimmy,
and I
fishy.
Think I'm kind of a balance of those two for sure. On.
So my fellow fish.
Yes. Next. Oh, yes, next. I've so put my trust in you that you are, you know, in charge of this whole system.
Right.
Okay, let's go with number 13.
How many push-ups can you do?
Ah, I used to be able to do more, but I'm just getting back into shape again. I mean, I can do a legit probably 15, and then I can kind of limp out another 5.
Okay.
You know.
Right on. That's hard. I mean,
yeah. There. Don't make me show you.
Yeah, I should. Get out the camera.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, next.
Let's do number 49.
What's your favorite time of day?
Oh, like 2 a.m.
Wow.
I am such a night owl.
Wow.
My creativity like doesn't even kick in until 11 p.m. So I do, I don't do my auditions that late, but I do my auditions in the evening. And, you know, waking up in the morning and doing them, it would just be a disaster. Like, I would sound
how
like
did you,
survive the real
how
world.
How did you survive early years of motherhood?
Oh, I know. It was
rough.
But
brutal.
She, not only did she come out doing jazz hands, but she came out sleeping.
A night owl?
Yeah, she's a night owl too. Yeah, we are.
My daughter came out sleeping. I mean, she's always been a sleeper.
Oh, well, what a blessing. That is the best blessing
such
of motherhood.
Such a blessing. From the time she was 3 months old, she slept for 8 to 10 hours.
Oh, my God. That's
seriously
amazing.
Seriously, she still sleeps 12 hours.
Yeah, that's mine great. Too. Yeah. I know. If she's only getting 9, she's like panicked.
Right.
She's like, wait, I'm only going to get 9 hours
that's
of sleep.
Not
I
enough.
Was like, dear God. Okay.
Next.
9. Let's go with 9.
Are you cynical?
Yes. You know, like the Pisces-Virgo split. I would say I'm more sunny and optimistic. But I definitely have a dark, cynical side. And what I have noticed over the years is that I tend to be the foil to whoever I'm sitting with. So if I'm sitting with somebody with a really, really bubbly, upbeat, sunny disposition, I become like negative Nelly, just as a balance. Like
sure,
I'm
sure,
constantly
sure.
balancing,
yeah.
You know. Even when I drive on the 405 or whatever, if there's room to move, I'm always the car that balances the lanes,
totally
right? Do you do
that? Yeah.
Right.
It's spatial.
It's spatial. Like I'm like, oh my God, why are there 6 cars in this lane and none in this lane? Like I have to balance it out, right? So, so I think my cynicism is a natural balance to my optimism, which usually wins out in the end.
Excellent. All right, next.
Mm-hmm. Oh, 21.
Who do you miss the most?
Oh, gosh. I'm being flooded.
Yeah.
I would say my parents.
Yeah.
Yeah. They loved me. Oh, my goodness. Like, I was adopted. And so I think there was just that extra layer of like, God, we
went and got you.
We went and got you.
Yeah.
And I, now being a mother, right, and watching my daughter do anything, like just the pride that, you know, just oozes out of you. Not so much based on the accomplishment, but the joy that is emanating from them. And I just remember now flashing back and just seeing tears in my parents' eyes every time I did anything, you know, and knowing that I gave them the gift that my daughter is giving me,
it just, the full circle,
it's delicious.
Yeah, that is.
It's a good question, though.
It is a good question.
Gave me pause.
Next.
Oh, I keep.
No,
geez.
It's okay.
I have myself in your hands. let's go with number 42.
What's your favorite cocktail?
Oh, I would say a crowd pleaser, which I had in New York.
What's a crowd pleaser?
I don't even know. It's fruity. It's fruity and punchy and really, really strong. And there's definitely vodka and there's a mix of other things. And
it's called a crowd pleaser?
It's called a crowd pleaser. And I have to tell you, I was pleased. I was.
But were you
pleasing
the crowd?
And I was pleased, and I was pleasing. I do believe I can say that it was a really, really fun night.
So funny. Okay, number 8.
Oh,
I think it's 8.
8. Oh yeah, we're on
number 8.
So let's make it number 8.
Okay.
I love the number 8.
Do you
just
go
around? Yeah,
it's very fishy.
Yeah, it is very fishy.
It's very Piscean.
Yeah.
Do you have a journal?
I have about 16 journals that I have started and the beginning of every journal is like, I know I haven't journaled in a long time, so let me catch you up. And then 4 years later, you know,
I'm very attracted to empty journals at a bookstore and I go, oh, that's so pretty.
Yeah, I know.
Gotta get that. And then it sits on the shelf.
Yeah. So I'm one of those. it's amusing to me when I read back on them, but sometimes I actually don't like it. They're cringeworthy to me. I'm just like, oh God, was I that? unaware, like, oh, and
yeah, oh. I have cringeworthy, like, things that have been published that are cringeworthy.
Oh, God. Oh,
wish I could take that back.
Yeah.
All right.
27.
What song would you like played at your funeral?
Ah, I've actually given my funeral a good amount of thought.
Have you?
But I don't know if I...
You thought about songs.
Yeah, well, I mean,
time to start. Callie,
thinking
about
my
songs.
Daughter, has already got the whole thing planned. I mean, we already have like the video reel, because we make in our spare time, we make these ridiculous videos of us just like goofing around and stuff. And I am going to be buried in a coffin filled with rainbow sprinkles, because that is my heaven, you know. And so I figure when I get eaten by the maggots and stuff, they'll have a lot to go through before they even get to me. So I'll be very well preserved
very
in there.
Very well preserved.
So what song would I want to be?
They're not supposed to get in.
Well, the... you know. Yeah, I know. You're paying enough for the,
right?
For the premium wood. What song? You know what? I'd like to pass and come back to that.
Okay.
Okay. Because it should be profound. But all I can think about now is that
sprinkles.
Girl is a real crowd pleaser. But it's only because of the last question, so.
That is so funny. Okay, choose another.
Okay, how many are we on? This is 9?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do number 15.
Do you untie your shoes when you take them off?
I've just recently begun wearing these, and I have to because they're tight. But no, normally I would be a kicker offer.
A kicker offer.
Yeah.
All right, one more.
Okay, let's go with number 50.
Name something most people don't know about you.
I eat like a 5-year-old, unsupervised in a candy store.
You like sugar.
I like sugar, and I seem to get away with it. But I'm also very deeply spiritual, very, very much so.
You have a master's degree in spiritual psychology.
Yeah, which is something most people don't even know exists. But it's basically...
Oh, I'm totally fascinated. I was watching you.
Yeah. It's a very interesting perspective on, you know, seeing what patterns have been created in your life many times to protect you and to keep you safe and to help you, you know, kind of endure certain situations. And then those patterns have been set into place and they may be limitations now. And just learning how to get to the root of them, heal them with love and self-forgiveness and compassion, and then, you know, kind of starting from a clean slate and moving forward. So there's a lot of meditation involved, a lot of just seeing the world through soul-centered eyes, mm-hmm. you know, and yeah. and connecting from the heart to people and setting intentions. And I use it in my work all the time.
Yeah.
You know, before I go into the booth, I'll look at the copy and I'll go, where's the love? You know, I'll try to find the love in every script, whether it's obvious, you know, sometimes it's obvious because you're doing a script about children's hospital or, mm-hmm. you know, something really easy. But if like pot roast is on sale for $4.99 at Vons, right?
Right.
You're like, well, where's the love in that? And you think, you know, what if somebody who's really going through a hard time, like hears that and goes, oh, I can provide dinner for my family tonight.
Yeah.
I honestly think of those things as I read the copy,
uh-huh.
because I know that I get out of my head and into my heart, because I know that that, you know, gets transmitted through the voice. It's
sure.
a vibrational instrument.
Mm-hmm.
All energy is a vibration. And hopefully I send that out into the airwaves, and that's what's received, whether
yeah.
it's booked or not, you know, it's
yeah.
still
mm-hmm.
out there.
Yeah.
And so that's like the footprint I'd like to leave.
You know, I heard, you know how you hear about people who are particularly adept at math.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have a mind for math
yeah.
or a mind for language. And I cannot remember for the life of me where I read this, but that understanding and seeing things from a spiritual point of view is also something that certain people are adept at.
Oh, interesting.
And that it's not necessarily possessed by everyone in the same way that not everyone sort of has advanced capacity for math.
Right, which I do not.
I think we all have, we can add and
yeah.
we can subtract
sure.
and we can make change and
mm-hmm.
we can balance our checkbooks most of the time and understand those really basic rudimentary things
mm-hmm.
which, you know, which help us get along in
sure.
life. Same with understanding things on a basically spiritual level, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then there are those who have sort of a unique capacity
yeah.
for it that is, in their DNA.
Yeah.
And I wish I could find the article because I found it so fascinating.
If you do, send it to me. I would love to read it. Yeah. I also do think, like anything else, right? If you're not particularly gifted in math, if you work it like a muscle and mm-hmm. you study harder, you get better at it. I think it's the same. And I think spending time immersed in spiritual readings and, you know, if you are plugged into a church or, you know, just spending time in that energy field and then meditation, prayer, whatever works for you. I just think, you know, it's that outliers theory of 10,000 hours. And
We get better. At that, which we practice.
Yes. You know, absolutely.
Okay. So I have one last question for you. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say to you when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Here's your ice cream sundae. You earned it. no, I don't know. You know what? That wouldn't be so bad.
That would be pretty good, I think.
Yeah. I think I would like him to say, here's your ice cream sundae. You loved as deeply as you could, and I'm very proud of you.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Tina Roscoe, thank you so much for joining me in the Beehive.
This was so much fun.
Tell everyone where they can find you if they want to hear your work.
Sure.
Or if you tweet or Insta. Yes. Or
yeah, I'm on Instagram at Tina Roscoe. Twitter, the same. My website is tinamorasco.com, TINAMORASCO.com. You can hear me every Monday night on HGTV on Love It or List It, and do some channel surfing and catch me on camera as well. And I also am available for coaching for voiceover.
Great.
And
fantastic.
Yeah. All of that.
And with
stuff.
All of that experience as an agent and a demo producer I bet you're a fantastic coach.
Well, thank you. So. I enjoy it. And I think that's the most important part is I really love seeing new people succeed.
Yeah. So fantastic. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. What a joy.
Pleasure.
Mwah. Mwah.
Thanks for joining me today in the Beehive. For podcast notes, pictures, and more information on my guests, visit the podcast website, thebeehivepodcast.com. Find me at my website, kbess.com. Follow me on Twitter at kbess and subscribe to my channel on YouTube. If you've a mind to, please post a review of the podcast on iTunes. Kind words are like honey, sweet to the soul and good for the bones. Come back for more Women in Voiceover next time in the Beehive.